listening to the Defenestrate Media Network.
It's Roast with J.M. Bell and Tom. Here are your Roastmasters.
Roastmasters.
I think I like the other one better.
I do. I like them all. I'm pretty easy. So
yes, like a Sunday morning.
Oh, I'm not that easy. In fact, let me tell you something. And I may or may not go into detail, but Sunday mornings the last few weeks have honestly been the biggest kick in the nuts that I can get my hands on. Sunday mornings are fucking awful. I have no idea what the hell that song's about because there's nothing easy. There's nothing easy about a Sunday morning. You go back to when I was a kid and we had to get up to get ready to go to church. That sucked. That wasn't easy. You know, most Sundays when I was in my 20s, I was basically coming down or waking up with a hangover. So that wasn't easy.
Me waking up in somebody else's bed. Ow! Ow! Ow!
Who am I? Where am I?
And now, why am I under this underpass? Why am I covered in somebody else's vomit?
Or ladies' undies. But, and then, in my 30s, I had the little kids.
The rest of the week.
Yeah. In my 30s, I had the kids. They were wee and small. Now I'm in my 40s, and it's basically I wake up to getting my ass kicked verbally by someone and other things. So I'm just wondering, what the fuck is that fucking song about? Song's a piece of shit. Song's a fucking lie is what it is.
It's a fucking lie is what it is. Lionel should know better. Even though he was in, the band that gave us Strawberry Letter 23. Okay? All right. I love that song. But I have problems with everything else he did.
Yeah. Hello? Is it me you're looking for?
The Brothers Johnson. That's right.
Okay.
The Brothers Johnson. That's who they were.
Were they cowboys?
No, they were R&B.
They were
70s R&B.
They were the baddest hombres to ever walk down the streets of Tombstone till Wyatt and his brothers showed up. The Brothers Johnson. Used to walk around with sashes made of paisley. You could call him a cocksucker, but you couldn't call him coward. Oh my
See,
God!
The problem is that, like, I'm listening to you, and it's like I'm getting little fade outs, like as we're talking, and just like driving me effing crazy.
Well, you know what? It's going to sound great on my end.
So. Oh, it's going to sound great on your end.
Yeah,
it will.
Yeah,
it will.
Look, here's the thing, and I'm going to throw this out there to the folks listening.
That's okay.
That have missed it. First, I'm gonna beg for money, and then I'm gonna tell you where the fuck we've been for the last 2 weeks because this is my fault. But I have found a way, sir. I have found a way in which, for a mere $50 a month, I can get the like you were in the studio broadcast quality.
No,
so
like ISDN's quality type,
like that. Yes,
stuff.
And it's basically I would have or you would have. This central thing, and then I can have one person join at a time on an ISDN quality line, and it's $50 a month. So,
like a node.
Yeah. So you know, we're asking if you guys pop over to the Patreon, I can pick that up, and then you can enjoy Tom and his dulcet tones as they were meant to be heard from out of his mouth into your ear holes. It's Tom.
And you told me, somebody told me once I was a tenor. Somebody told me I was a tenor. I didn't know what the hell I was.
Yeah, I do.
But that's the sound of a tenor. You're like kind of a baritone. You're kind of like a mix baritone kind of, you're
basso profundo.
You're basso profundo. You are, man.
Expecto.
You are. Jeffrey, you are.
Expecto patronum.
Patronus.
Wingardium leviosa. So my dad is 81 years old and just went in for open heart triple bypass surgery a couple of weeks ago. Now, he went into the Veterans Administration Hospital here in Salt Lake City. And you hear horror stories about the VA all over the country. And the one thing I have to say, with the exception of paperwork bullshit, and wait times for a lot of the guys, that you have with the non-life-threatening stuff. This is the third or fourth time my dad's been up to the VA for something serious in Salt Lake City. And his doctors are top-notch. The facility is as good as it could possibly be for what it is in the VA system. The surgeons are great. The nurses and the physician's assistants and the whatever that other one is that can prescribe meds. All of them were amazing. They were delightful. They were attentive. They had their shit together. And so with the exception of the fact that my dad's wife kept leaving town for the 2 weeks that he was in there, I can't explain that, but she apparently needed to drive a 10 to 12 hour round trip to water her plants for 3 days. Twice. Okay. Okay. I don't fucking get it, but whatever. So, you know, and this is dad's, he was married to my mother, and then he divorced her, and then he married my stepmom, who I called mom, and was married to her for almost 30 years, and then she passed away from heart failure due to diabetes. Oh. Long, long suffering. I mean, she had diabetes for decades, and so she went, and then a couple of years later, he married this new lady, and she is, you know, sort of energetic. She lives in her own little fucking world. You know, she plays to the beat of her own drummer no matter what's going on stage, and it was really important for her to go down, water her plants, and do church work for a couple of days while her husband was in the hospital with a cracked open chest. And the whole family's just standing around going, the fuck? So that's what it is. So that's where I have been. I have spent as many nights as I can, to the point that he went home yesterday, right? And, yes. And I went and dropped my kid and her boyfriend off downtown where they work. And because I was downtown, I'm like, oh, I'll just go up. So I went, you know, 14 blocks out of my way, went up to the VA, parked the car, walked in, and got halfway to where his room used to be before I remembered he wasn't there anymore. That's how many times I've been up there. So wow. I went down to the canteen, I got myself a sandwich, and I sat and bullshitted with some of the nurses. And when I say nurses, you may think, naughty nurses. No, most of these dudes are as big as me, covered in tattoos. You know, they look badass as hell. Don't get me wrong. There were some very, very lovely ladies. But for the most part, these are just big dudes. They're fucking great. They just sit around. They bust each other's chops. They bullshit with the patients. My dad and them were teasing each other. All my dad's insults from being in the army in the 50s kept popping back up. Dirty bird, feather merchant. It was awesome. And then I'd go down and to the smoker's deck and sit around with all these basically Vietnam vets and bullshit about motorcycles and helicopters. So you take away the terror of waiting for an 81-year-old man to basically sneeze and crack his chest back open. Once that's out of the way, it was a really interesting time. I don't see my dad very often. He lives a long way from here, and he lives where it's hot. And I say that knowing that it was 103 where I live today, and whereas down where my dad lives, it was 120-something. So there's a lot of the year I don't see him. But yeah, that's where we've been.
If you're out in upstate New York and you're traveling along Route 13 and you're going through Truxton or Kyler or Fabius or New Woodstock or Sheds, that's nowhere near where my dad was when he was in the VA. Where they put him in for the last year and a half of his life, he was really, really well taken care of. They loved him. And my dad is in no way ever easy, was ever easy to deal with in any way, as he had dementia. And he was just generally an ornery motherfucker toward the end. And I can say that. I can say that with great confidence. And I have to say that, thank God, facilities like this, and thank God my siblings were able to get him in. He obviously was very, very delusional, thinking he could, you know, work out the rest of his life inside of his apartment and just live a normal, you know, regular life. But when you're found face down in the floor and the oven is on fire and there's smoke in the room, obviously there are a few things that need to be taken care of. Mostly the fact that you have to vent the room. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
So with him, that issue is now no longer any issue, as he's passed more than a year and a half ago. And I have to say that thank God that there was something there for him. I don't think anybody in my family actually had, if they had to take care of him, God forbid. But thank God the VA was there.
Yeah.
It was there for him.
No, VA's been good to my dad. Bought him a house, or helped him buy a house once. It only apparently does it once. Put it through college.
Put him through college.
Yeah, it's one of the things when you look at how we in America used to treat our veterans. Okay, before we move on, off on a rant. I was driving in the car. I had both my kids. I had Matt and Kyla with me last night. And out of nowhere, both of them were like, "Dad, we miss your old voice." And I said, "What are you talking about, my old voice?" And they're like, "Your podcast voice, the voice, your announcer voice. You don't use it anymore on the show." And I'm like,
"Oh, that's nice."
So if you go back to some, like even our first 100 some odd episodes on the Left Show,
yeah,
I did an intro on that, that I would sit there and painfully write to make sure that it was clever and relevant, failed most of the time. But then I would turn on my version of the Happy Disney guy. And
Mark. Yeah, that guy.
And so my kids, they begged. And I have not done it in a long time, but it's the old voice. It's the bumper voice for your show, for Coffee Cast.
It is. You did a fantastic job for it too.
And it's
Mark Elliott, who's who you're talking about.
Yes,
Mark Elliott. You know, the most American famous voiceover artist for incredible happiness.
You know, it's not happy enough. You gotta sound happier for Mark.
You really have got to believe the incredible happiness. No, I'm just too cynical. You're great for that. You really are. Wow. See, that's what I was trying to get at. Like right now, I want to be able to just talk and not really be terribly concerned about my voice and just try to get shit out that way instead of like going, okay, well, how am I going to sound and how am I going to get across? Fuck that shit. All I want to do is just be able to express what's been going on the last couple of weeks. But I have to say, from the sound of it, that's a very sweet thing that your kids said. That's really great.
They do. They liked it. It was, and the problem with it is that if you use it for 5 minutes, it's there. And it used to be, my thing was, is I have found that the most parasitic affectation was when I was living in Minnesota. There are bits and pieces of that accent that I will never get rid of. Like,
When were you in Minnesota?
I was in Minnesota from 98 to 2001. And the great state of Minnesota. To the point where I can't say Minnesota without saying Minnesota.
Oh, no, you can't say that without saying Minnesota. Yeah. Oh, no.
So
I knew a lot of Minnesotans. I knew, you know, there's some Minnesotans in the family. So, yeah, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. Here's the other thing about voiceover, in case you guys always want to know. You want to absolutely try to get rid of every instance of mouth clicks and tiskings as much as possible. Get rid of that shit. Do you know that there are like apps and shit that you could use, like programs that can get rid of crap like that without having to go in and clip out all that shit? Amazing.
Yeah, they do.
Technology. It's delicious.
I want.
And it's good for you.
I want that app. I got okay.
$50.
Yeah,
it's $150.
Never mind. I don't want that app.
Money.
I'd like to do. Money. I'd like you and I to do an hour auto-tuned. That's what I want.
Oh jeez, auto-tune. Oh god, that gives me fits. I guess I could do it. I suppose I could. But I mean, this whole thing started 10 years ago. What is it now? 16, 17. No, maybe 11 years ago. Hold on a second here. Hold on.
So, all right. Who won the coin toss today?
You did.
Oh, shit. Okay. Mine is simple. No, we don't take a break here. We take a break in a little while. So, mine is simple today. And I would like to take you back to July 13th of 1985. Join me, if you will, at the Wembley Stadium in London. Yes? Quite. Prince Charles.
1985. Are we talking about Live Aid? Is that what we're talking about?
You know, I was building up to a reveal, sir.
I killed it.
Prince Charles and Princess Diana, Your turn. No. Anyway, it was Live Aid. Now, I know that there are some of those adorable little millennials listening right now who have no idea what I'm talking about. So let me explain. Live Aid was a worldwide rock concert. It was organized to raise money for famine relief in several countries in Africa. It started at Wembley. It continued at JFK in Philadelphia and traveled to a bunch of other arenas all over the world, simulcast in 110 nations. It had over 1 billion viewers on satellite TV. And kids, when I'm talking satellite TV, I'm not talking dish. I'm not talking, it's not that. These were big fucking satellites. You might have remembered seeing them in your grandparents' backyard.
Anyways, so when you walk and you take a look at the big ones, those are called C-bands. That's the way the old satellite used to be.
And it had, for scrambled porn, the easiest to see boobs. So anyway, this was Bob Geldof. Now, okay, this is my last millennial reference because kids, you should have found the Boomtown Rats by now. If for no other reason than y'all were just coming of age, hopefully round about one school shooting or another, and that song always pops up. Anyway, Bob Geldof.
I don't like Mondays.
I don't either. But Sundays are a lie. like Bob Geldof, was the lead singer of the Boomtown Rats, and he had gone to Ethiopia after hearing about the famine. And you have to realize that this was a drought, famine, disease laden thing that killed hundreds of thousands of people in just one country. And there were millions more that looked like they were going to die. So he comes back to London. He gets his little black book out because we didn't have smartphones then, and calls all of his buddies together and people he doesn't know. And they get together and do they know it's Christmas?
Good. Now, I'm glad you brought that up because that's what happened the Christmas before. That was 84, correct?
Yep, that was 84.
84. That was from Britain. Mostly. Oh, no. Hold on. Wait.
30 years ago, Live Aid rocked the world to raise money for humanity.
There's another clip. Wait. Go on.
Okay.
sorry.
You know what? I don't care. This is fun. It's live. We're doing it live.
Fuck it.
Anyway, he wrote it with Madge Ure. From Ultravox. Go look it up.
Oh, Ultravox. Yeah, Midge Ure. Yes. Yeah,
you're going to like that one. Anyway, and it was performed by this giant ensemble of Duran Duran, Wham. It says U2, but I honest to God, I think I saw Edge, and I know that Bono was there. Phil Collins, previously of Genesis, Culture Club, Boy George. I mean, it was a room full of very, very fancy talking white people. And so the single sold by itself and raised about $10 million. Number one hit in the United States, which caused Americans, because we can't leave well the fuck enough alone, to record We Are the World.
That's right.
That was, then this is funny, Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie. And that...
Because who produced it?
As I recall, that was Quincy Jones.
Quincy. That's right.
So who's, USA for Africa.
Yes, go on.
USA for Africa, it was called, because Band-Aid is a bunch of British people getting together to do something nice for the world. USA for Africa is a bunch of Americans who are number one and want everybody to know it. And they raised $44 million. So, you know what, Bob Geldof? Suck it. USA for Africa had Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Bob Geldof, Harry Belafonte, Bob Dylan, Cyndi Lauper, Paul Simon, Bruce Springsteen, Tina Turner, Stevie Wonder, fucking Ryan, what's his name? That other guy, that white dude over there. I mean, it was like one mullet after another. It was either mullets or Jerry Curls in that studio. So Ethiopia kept getting worse, and Sudan was getting worse. And so Geldof put together Live Aid. Okay, because you can't let the Americans win with that $44 million. After all, he got was a mere $10 million, and for what it's worth, though, there's a lot less people in England than there are here. Just saying. So he put it together, and he put it together fast. It was on a Saturday, July 13th, 1985. 75 acts all over the world, including Elton John, Madonna, Mick Jagger, David Bowie, Queen. Fucking Queen, Duran Duran, U2, The Who, Brian Adams, Sting, Sade. Did I say Run DMC? Because DMC was there. Neil Young, Tom Petty, Eric Clapton, blah, 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 blah. And so most of these guys were performing at Wembley Stadium. 70,000 people in the stadium, 100,000 people in Philadelphia, because we're number one. We were then. So... Live Aid, this big fucking thing that you could probably do today with cell phones, and Facebook Live, but it raised $127 million for famine relief in the African nations, and it generated enough attention that many Western nations started to make available enough surplus grain to end the immediate hunger crisis in African nations. Geldof, I Don't Like Mondays, lead singer of the Boomtown Rats, was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II, as was everybody else in the last 200 years, I believe. She's that old, right? So, she's like a vampire. I think.
She just keeps going on. My next door neighbor actually had one date with her.
Really?
But she ditched him.
I didn't see that in The Crown.
It wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wasn't there at all. But we go on. We move on.
Yes, moving on. So anyway, after that he put together Live 8. I don't know if you remember this. This was in 2005.
Yes.
And that was a big concert before
Philadelphia.
Yeah, before the London. G8 summit to put pressure on the G8 nations to address issues facing poor countries. And 3 billion people watched over 1,000 musicians perform over 11 shows, broadcast on 182 television networks, 2,000 radio stations. Live 8 was not a fundraiser. Geldof's slogan at that one was, "We don't want your money, we want your voice." And so after that, the nations of the G8 voted to cancel the debt of 18 of the world's poorest nations, make AIDS drugs more accessible, and double the levels of annual aid to Africa by 50 million, up to 50 million, billion, sorry, apologies, by 2010. Now, usually when I do this, I pick three or four things that have happened. I draw a correlation to between then and now. And here's the best I have. Okay. It's not that we don't give as much of a shit as we used to, because something like this is not the spectacle that it used to be. When you can do this on a phone, when you can, it desensitizes you as the participant to you know what happens as a spectacle. So you look back at Katrina relief. Had Kanye West, here's the thing.
My God.
I didn't watch it. I watched the clips of poor Mike Myers standing there next to Kanye West having a Canadian poop in his pants. You know? And the truth is as fucking nuts as Kanye is, I agree with the guy. Absolutely 100% on that point. And so we have some flood relief from time to time. We had the island nation that got hit by the hurricane, and a bunch of guys that recorded there did some stuff. And so we do from time to time have spectacle, but they don't seem to work the way that they used to. And part of it, I believe, is that we are far more interconnected now than we used to be. And instead of, you know, gearing up for 3 weeks to watch a thing, you know, we could just put a like and a happy face on Facebook. Because I don't know about you guys, and yes, this is really where I'm going to end my segment, but when U2 gives you an album for free, that if you don't like it, you can just delete it and the whole fucking world gets livid, we have really, really lost sense with where we are and what's important. So I guess at this point I'm saying I think it's time for Bob Geldof to pay attention to Michigan. And that maybe we could raise some awareness about the people in Michigan that are being poisoned by their government via their water. It was a tantrum I had. You may have heard me yell about it on the Left Show. But they still don't have clean water. It's been years later. They still have poisoned
years
water.
Years later.
And the governor
just throws people at it, instead of him, of course. Yeah. But all their policies led to that conclusion, that end. Because they cannot, people who live in Flint, Michigan, cannot drink their own water because of the greed and pure incompetence, deliberate attempts to make things more profitable, not just for the county, but for the state, in whatever process that they're using. And the process that they're using is to be able to take what was a certain source of water and replace it with a source of water that caused the very pipes to rust.
Yeah.
And create contaminants and lead in people's drinking water in America. And it's just, that's extraordinary.
All right. I think on that note, we should probably take a little break and then come back with whatever you were going to thrill us with.
Excellent. I like that.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Hey, folks. Jeff here.
And JC here.
Oh, and Taylor.
I want to talk to you about Patreon. Patreon is how, for the most part, we are paying the bills around here.
Come on, help us pay some bills.
It's important. These shows cost money to both make and distribute, and we don't ask for money very often. And what we're asking for here is you, as a listener, pitching in $5, $10 a month, over the course of the year to help us grow and get bigger. We need it now. More than ever.
But look, you're not just throwing us money. We're going to give you something really unique for your money. Normally, everything you get from us is free. You get a free download of our podcast, The Left Show, the world's greatest podcast, comic book podcast, and of course...
The truck stop visits.
Yeah, the truck stop visits and Geek Therapist. And instead, we're going to give you exclusive content, stuff that we record separately that is then put out for only you to listen to.
Yeah, and I don't have dollar restrictions on that stuff. You pitch in $5 a month, you pitch in $25 a month, that's it. There are goals there if you do throw in a little bit extra. We send you presents as soon as I can find them.
Yeah.
And for those of you that are waiting for presents, I just need to find the boxes. Don't worry about it. But no, with Geek Therapist, the world's greatest comic book podcast, and of course this, The Left Show, and our exclusive content, you get more as a Patreon member of our family than you do anywhere else. So go to the website for your favorite of the Defend Media families, whether that be theleftshow.com, worldsgreatestpodcast.com, or geektherapist.com. Click on the Patreon button, become a part of the family, and start getting the cool shit nobody else is getting.
You know you want it. You know you do.
Just do it.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org, but you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Okay, I've got a few things. Jeff, this is a few things that I want to talk about. What made what you were talking about with Live Aid so unique is the unpredictability of a live performance. Nobody really knows that prior to Jimi Hendrix coming on to the stage early morning as the last act on the last day at Woodstock, they're preceded by a 30-minute routine by Sha Na Na. which nobody remembers ever. But the one thing people do recall, and always who
I remember Sha Na. I love Sha Na.
But they don't remember that performance. That wasn't the defining performance. Jimmy's performance was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jimmy's was. A lot of people's performances were. 10 years after was. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It a whole bunch of stuff. There is a moment that makes careers happen. Something happens. Something unpredictable that maybe that they just sheer by the energy of the band or to just maybe by the performance or maybe something that was planned like Michael Jackson's moonwalk at the Motown show that just captivated everybody's interest. And at Live Aid, what happened is that U2's performance was they're really literally on shaky ground at the time. U2 walked into that stadium kind of not really like with all engines running and everything, you know, happening for them. They didn't hit the stage with a lot of confidence. And they only had 17 minutes. But what happened was, and I'm reading this straight out from an article here. This is one thing that I do remember. If you read Rolling Stone, they go minute by minute about what happened in this event. During a 12-minute rendition of Bad that incorporated bits of Lou Reed and Rolling Stones, Bono climbs down from the stage, and he still has a huge gap between himself and the first row of people that are right up front who are getting crushed. Okay? He pulls out three girls, you know, two who start, like, dancing with him. And for some particular reason, it wasn't just that what was going on there while the band was improvising and trying to just like, how long are we going to keep doing this?
Right.
What's he doing? Why is this happening? So he was not only frustrated, you know, Bono was frustrated that the girls weren't being lifted up to him on the stage, vaulted off the apron of the stage into the muddy ground, 10 feet below, out of view of the band, out of view of the crowd of Wembley. Nobody knows what the hell was going on. They thought that he just had fallen and they didn't see him anymore. So what happened is that he brought them up on stage and they were overwhelmed. He was just starting to dance with them, just trying to get some energy going. When something, he goes, I'll quote from Rolling Stone. During this time, three musicians who have been heroically vamping with Clayton throwing in minor but compelling variations on his bass line. It was kind of excruciating. We didn't even know if we should stop. We didn't know where he was. We didn't know if he had fallen. Edge goes, Bono's dive into the crowd went a bit wrong because he had so much stuff to climb over to get to the front row. It was a massive stadium show. Go online and take a look. Take a look at Wembley. I mean, 100,000 or more people were there. This sea of people for as far as you can see. Okay. So they're on, and I think it's probably, if I'm not mistaken, 5 o'clock in London, noontime in New York. I'm watching, and I was living in Alaska at that time. So it's 8 a.m. Okay. The whole world is seeing it at different times and different places. So he goes, Edge goes on and says, we lost sight of Bono completely. He was gone for so long. Maybe he decided to end the set early and was on his way to the dressing room. That's how kind of this was. So they've had a couple of hits in the beginning, and they were, yeah, I think this is before Joshua Tree.
Let me jump in.
Go on.
Because I don't know if you know this or not, but U2's kind of my thing.
Well, I love U2.
They at that time were having struggles with nearly extreme Christianity and a return to spirituality, you know, to the Irish Catholic that all of them probably were. And at some point in here, they were having conflict about that. And the briefcase that held all the lyrics for the new album was stolen.
Wasn't it in Portland?
I thought it was in Belize or Barbados. But wherever,
that's right.
They had studio time coming up in a couple of weeks, and they just lost their entire fucking album. And so when they rewrote it, that's how we got songs like Gloria. And if you go back and listen to that whole album, it's very Jesus. you know, and so all around that time, they were a little button heads. Now, I, as a super fan, who liked the fucking free album, You Good for Nothing Nobodies, you know, I really did like the album. What can I say? The only one I don't
that
really
was
like.
Unforgettable Fire. That was out of the Unforgettable Fire. That came out in 84. And that was they released later that year in October.
Yeah. And Unforgettable Fire blew up. And then in October blew up. And then Joshua Tree.
Pride in the Name of Love. And yeah. Then Joshua Tree absolutely just rang it for them. Rang that bell.
And I don't care what anybody says, Tom. I loved Rattle and Hum. I thought it was an awesome
Rattle and Hum. I love Rattle and Hum. I don't give a shit what people say. I love that album.
Yeah,
I love that film. I thought it was great. I really do.
Go ahead. Pray. Continue.
I'm that kind of fanatic. I'll even continue on this.
Okay.
Because maybe this is what we talk about this week. But it goes like this. It was such a moment. This is what made the difference between them struggling and then just winning over Wembley and the world.
Right.
So at this point, they just don't know what the hell is going on. The band is still vamping. You know, Edge was totally thrown, and he's looking at Adam and Larry to see if they know what's going on. And they're looking back at me with complete panic across their faces. And he concludes, I'm just glad cameras didn't show the rest of the band during the whole drama, because we must have looked like the Three Stooges. And just as the band is just about to stop playing, Bono clambers up a ladder through a group of photographers back on the apron in clear view again. And Bono says, I'd gone AWOL to try to find a television moment. I forgot about the song. Into the song, Melanie and Elaine Hills are standing up on the apron. They're waiting for Bono. He embraces Melanie. He twirls her around, pulls Elaine in to join the hug, giving her a kiss on the forehead. It was a really big wet kiss, Elaine said. And he had all this stubble and sweat, and I thought, well, woo. Bono wheels around, his right arm outstretched, looking for a microphone, knowing that Greg Carroll, the roadie, will bring one to him. In his field of vision, on stage, on the right, is the clock. It's now 5:34 in London. Carroll detaches the microphone from the stand and jumps onto the apron. He hands it to Bono, 8:36. Kick it off, Bono shouts, audible once more. Elaine Hills climbs off the apron to rejoin the crowd. Bono walks over and plants another kiss on her, so he gets two off. Mullen goes into a dramatic fill, relieved to have a break from the drum pattern he's been playing over and over and over again. Here we go, Bono yells.
Oh, yeah.
He knows that this venture into the crowd has taken all the time allotted for the band to play their third song, Pride in the Name of Love. This will be U2's final song of the day, so when he launches into Bad, he gives it everything he has. Let's go. Go. Let it go. 9:43, after an electrifying chorus, the band returns to the same lick they've been vamping on. Bono sings, I'm not sleeping, and he starts quoting other rock songs. First, Ruby Tuesday, and turns into a sing-along. Then the Stones' Sympathy for the Devil, throwing his body into a doubled-over spasm on each line before segueing into Lou Reed's Take a Walk on the Wild Side. Tens of thousands of people start singing doo-doo-doo from the song, and Bono raps a modified version of the lyrics. Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked all the way across the USA. She could hear the satellite coming down. Pretty soon, she was in London town, Wembley Stadium. Bono was often enhanced Bad with snatches of other songs. The final score at Live Aid was two by the Stones, two by Lou Reed, sometimes in this era, but not on the same day, Beatles' Norwegian Wood and Elton John's Candle in the Wood. So at 11:30, Bono says, thank you. God bless you, drops the microphone like he just won a rap battle, clambers back onto the main stage, walks past the bandmates while they play the riff again, and on his way out, he grabs a white towel and waves to the crowd. Okay, so they cut to a chopper shot, okay, and they pull out, videos like going, okay, well, I guess that was the set. Meanwhile, the band finishes, they depart, and they have this enormous argument backstage. So Clayton and Mullen and the Edge were really unhappy with Bono, with what he did, who they felt like hung him out to dry and denied the band a chance to play Pride in the Name of Love. The consensus among the four band members was that the performance was clumsy. It was earthbound. We felt like we had an opportunity to be great. It was a great day, and we lost it. So, meanwhile, while they go out and they watch Queen just like knock over the entire stadium. So what happened was, is that it really took them by surprise when people started talking about U2 as one of the big performances of the day. So they all of a sudden began to hear, you know, within time, within a week or two, the charts, things just start picking up for them. The album was like, whatever albums that they had were like picking up play all over, you know, FM radio in the United States. And then all of a sudden, when he starts hearing about this, he thought, oh, you're just screwing with me. You're just joking. I thought we were really crap. So what happened was, is that in a sense of real total jeopardy, which is always really exciting for a live event, and Bono's complete determination to make some kind of contact with the crowd and eventually getting there after 2 minutes of struggling over barriers, there was something about the effort to put into it that made it worth more powerful. And Bono comes up later and he says, crap sound, crap haircuts. We didn't even play Pride in the Name of Love. They got... And the band wanted to fire me as a result, as it turned out to be one of the best days of our life. Explain that. Ask God. He probably knows.
Aw.
Great story. Great show. And I'm not even going into like what Queen did. Queen owned.
Yeah.
That night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Led Zeppelin even played. I mean, Page and Plant, probably Jason Bonham played with them. I mean, you know, Madonna was in Philadelphia, but Queen, my God. I mean, in the day, they just had an amazing, amazing ability and a performance skills. And if you're a Brit, you love your Queen. If you listen to British radio, British rock radio,
hello,
they love Queen.
Yeah.
No question. So they just pulled it off. But anyway, that was that day in history.
That's a good day, man. I remember it. I was 12. And I could not find anybody. No, I was 13. I could not find anybody in my area that had it on their TV show or on their TVs. So I listened
because MTV was probably the devil and you couldn't watch it.
It wasn't that. It was just I lived in an area where we didn't have cable, hadn't been run yet. And so there were parts of it that I did catch. And then over the years, I have done my best to reconstruct it. It was a huge moment. And even if you couldn't watch it, you were well fucking aware of it. And to be honest, you know, by that age, 13, man, I was still listening to the fucking Thompson Twins, but, with no shame, sir, no shame. I still,
and there's no shame. It's 80s music.
I love,
there's a lot of great 80s music.
Okay. Now you're just making fun of me. So
No, really, I do. It was a great decade. I mean, just like I even reveled in you know what. I didn't care. I loved it. It sounded great. There's a lot of great memories in that. A lot of far flung places I've been to, and good memories and good people. And I will never forget. There was some real shit.
Yeah.
But I pound for pound. I think that there was more to take away to just sail through the decade than there was through the 70s.
Well, okay. Let us take a break, and then we'll come back. And instead of doing our what have we learned bit, we could talk about the 80s and how awesome it was.
Let's do that.
Awesome.
There are 10 jillion podcasts in this crazy world, but there is only one that serves a fresh pot of, hi, how do you do? I'm Tom, your host of the Coffee Cast. My mission is to make it as compelling a listen as you'll find it. I'll talk about all kinds of subjects. Sometimes I'll have guests, good stories, because people listen to what interests them. And sometimes it's the Coffee Cast. So if you're listening as you're texting the 7th draft of a resignation message to the soon-to-be former psychopathic boss, gift shopping rotary phones for your great-great aunt, or skydiving for the first time without a parachute, whoops, welcome to the Coffee Cast. Remember, you can download a fresh Coffee Cast podcast anytime at Stitcher and iTunes, and now on demand on the Progressive Voices app and progressivevoices.com. So until the next podcast word, I'll do my best to keep it fresh. The Coffee Cast podcast.
I love the 80s. I do not like the show I Love the 80s, because I never liked that. But my growth path was, by the time 84 rolled around, my folks were splitting up. My dad moved out. I'm not gonna do this story today. Basically what it turned out is that mom ran off with all of us. And dad had the house, and so dad got a dog because he hadn't had a dog in 25 years. And then the court gave mom the house. Dad had to move out, and I had to get rid of the dog. And when you add every other problem that my mom and I have had with each other over the years, that was a big one. So I kept running away. My dad lived clear the hell across the valley, so probably 15-16 miles away, and I was burning through skateboard wheels. I ran away so much, and then finally one day mom just didn't let me back in. Dad's like, okay, I'll call the lawyer in the morning, and he had custody by the end of the week. So dad and I moved down into the sticks to be near my grandparents so that they could keep an eye on me. Yeah, it didn't work.
And good luck with that.
Don't get me wrong. I love my grandparents. My dad's folks were the best. And so, you know, I had come up from a certain direction. And at that particular time, especially around about 84, 85, my musical tastes were still, I had only been allowed to listen to shit that my mom would listen to, because kids are not supposed to have a sense of their own music. And the first album I fell in love with was Michael Jackson's Thriller. And that was, I'd say, the first album I fell in love with that wasn't something I heard on Dr. Demento. Let's be straight up. And so, yeah, and so that was the first. And up until that point, I'd been listening to fucking Ricky Green and Olivia Newton-John and the fucking Carpenters. And here's the thing. I still love that music. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down too. No, I love rainy days. Rainy days are awesome. Mondays can blow a donkey. But so coming into this particular time, I'm just becoming aware that music is music. And it doesn't have to be churchy. And it doesn't have to be that chick from Greece, which I wasn't allowed to watch because of Stockard Channing. I'm still upset about that. And so I somehow the fucking Beach Boys came into my head about this time, and the Monkees, and in a roundabout way, I had this girl named Heather on one side. It was this kind of semi new wave punk rock chick that lived up the street and was prettier than any girl I'd ever seen in my life at that point. And at the time, she was more to me than Marky Post ever could be.
Or Jan Smithers.
I don't know, man. Jan's pretty good. Marky Post was it, man. She was the thing on TV.
Anyway,
she was handing me off, Thompson Twins and Aztec Camera and the Eurythmics. And then on the other side, I was still having sort of an influence from Home and Hearth, and that was the Beach Boys, the Monkees. And Dad took us up to a concert. My mom had when I was 13, not let me go to see the Thompson Twins in concert because I was too young. And Dad, on the other hand, not only got me tickets to the Monkee show, and I know we talked about this one already.
Yes.
But we saw both shows. So by the time Live Aid pops up, I am looking for new. John Cougar Mellencamp's now in my head. The Moody Blues are now in my head. I am discovering the psychedelic 60s, 70s, and then all of the keyboard shit that the 80s have to offer. It was enlightening to a 13-year-old who was looking for something, and the internet did not exist yet. That is the most important thing for people listening to understand if they're not our age. We just couldn't go to fucking Spotify and find a playlist or have new artists pop up for us.
You had FM radio, you had MTV.
So the playbill was the thing that I went down it and then went and found all of those bands. to see who I liked and who I didn't. And that was, for me, Queen was new. That was not something that was big in Utah in any circle that I ran around in. And U2 was new. And all of these things that caused all that excitement and my going to the library to read Rolling Stone to figure out who was where and how it was. Live Aid, okay, yeah, it raised a lot of money and it fed a lot of hungry people. But for me, it was the beginning of the musical journey that, that has led me to not only play and sing and record my own stuff from time to time. And you know, then I don't know where I would have been or what I would have appreciated. I would probably still be driving in a Suzuki Samurai, listening to the greatest hits of Olivia Newton-John, you know, and the Carpenters and Captain and Tennille. Captain and Tennille. Me, the God. Suzuki Samurai. And Muskrat Sally and Muskrat Sam. And you're a little older than me, so you probably already had good music in your head by the time this shit hit.
Well, I'm going to try and wrap this in a way. It's going to try to make sense, but coming of awareness, you know, living in a house where you've got, you know, a pair of, like, Kennedy Democrat, you know, Irish Roman Catholics. You probably are picking up a lot of stuff from your parents' music, which was like Sinatra, swing, big band, you know, popular music, you know, from the 50s and 40s and stuff. So by the time I was aware of what was going on, my biggest influence was my older sister. And of course, it all began with the Beatles. And, you know, through the 60s, there's this conflict going on all the time between, you know, shutting down anything that was like brand new that I rebelled against eventually. And finally, when I did discover stuff, it was just mind blowing to be able to go through the entire catalog of all of the revolutionary work of the 60s, about how the 70s took a pit stop. And for some particular reason, maybe I was trying to impress my parents with once again trying to find a music that maybe everybody, you know, could like. And that's when I was into prog for a while. Coming out of that, just smashed and burned into punk, and just being taken in the late 70s by the simplicity, the brilliance, the primal essence of rock and roll, of what punk had become, as that went into new wave and then died for a little while. Everybody was picking up reggae. And when the revolution in the 80s began, it happened when MTV started and cable systems across the country began picking it up. And when you first started watching it, one of the things that they would do is they would record shows in a 4-hour block. So whoever had that time period had a series of shows. They were probably running those on probably Ampex, like one inch broadcast machines. They probably didn't have very many of them wherever they were broadcasting out of, because when they were done with that show, they either replayed that same 4 hours, maybe it was late at night, or they went on to the next tape that they had. But they would always have, because maybe what they're doing is that they're rewinding the tape for the next replay, they would play bumper. They would play a bumper tape that you can actually find that would just have this kind of vamp rock with cuts from stock video from anywhere, and you would just be mesmerized by just watching it. I would watch my younger brother and my younger sisters just kind of like get, you know, into the groove and find, you know, all the really incredible, you know, bands and the music that happened in the 80s. 90s got a little bit like more mature.
Right.
By the time the 2000s started coming along, you know, we were really getting busy with other stuff. But there are a few things that hold time for me. And in the 80s, there has to be for me, no matter whenever you want to play it, I don't care. Tainted Love for me just that's the quintessential 80s song. And if not, a lot of, you know, Tears for Fears, just simply because it just has that Euro synth, you know, kind of sound.
Yeah.
We go in and out about, you know, the police, and that is just a real shorthand approach to my musical experience. There are always brilliant, brilliant things, you know, that happened, you know, with Talking Heads. Lots of opportunities and things that came and went, but it was a chance for things to grow and to just flourish and to be what it wasn't before. And to me, that's the reason why when you skate through the 80s, politically, good God, it was the fucking worst, because you had Reagan and Bush. But the rest of, there's a lot of art and there's a lot of music.
You know, all right, so here's what we got in the 80s. We got the Mapplethorpe Photos. That's done nothing but cause problems since now. You've got the Reagan era policies, that era of big government's over, the government's the problem, all of this. The 80s started the avalanche that, the reason that we have Trump now. It was the 80s. It was the sensibility of the 80s. It was cocaine and dipshittery. On the other hand, you got really cool stuff, and I don't care. I will fight you. But Miami Vice was good TV. And if you go back and watch Miami Vice, you could see that, yes, I realize everybody's wearing pastels and loafers, and the cops shouldn't dress like that. But Edward James Olmos, I mean, that's where Admiral Adama comes from. There are good things that came out of the 80s. And for me, the most landmarked parts are U2, Joshua Tree, and then Everything Before, which I found, you know, like that. It was finding three copies of the 8-track of Pink Floyd's The Wall and an 8-track player at our version, Utah's version of the Goodwill. And listening in my room constantly, never turned off for 2 years, was Pink Floyd's The Wall, that just played and played and played and played. And then when the A-track would die, I'd pull that one out and stick another in. I got 2 years out of that. So when you play Pink Floyd's The Wall, yeah, I know all the words. Shut up. So, you know, I mean, I got really good stuff out of the 80s.
You got good stuff out of the 80s. Yeah. What I got was, God, I would have to just say it was just the stream of positivity and emotions that just carried me through some particularly difficult times, and still was able to come out on the other end. I started the decade literally just stepping out, you know, on my own with virtually no help. And by the end, I had met the woman who I am still currently married to and have a family with. And so there is meaning to that for me in my life. But I think that really the greater meaning can't be excused. It has to be this. It does. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
I knew this was coming. I don't care. I fucking love soda. Fucking song.
I love that song. Every time I'm at the grocery store, I get that song. I love that song.
He turned to me to say, as if to say, "Hurry, boy, is waiting there for you."
It was
just
waiting.
Look
it
at
was...
that video. Oh my God. Oh God, it's so. Oh.
It was waiting.
No, it was. It's almost as if nobody was like,
"I'm going to go."
When we of anything.
When we hang up, sir, I am going outside, and I am just going to sit and listen to Africa by Toto over and over again. I think it's beautiful, man. I think we end it here. This is where we should stop.
This is exactly where we should end it. And, you know, we actually have exit music. So why not? Jeff, it's been wonderful.
I missed you, buddy.
It was a great show. Oh, miss you too, man. We'll do it a lot more frequently. So until next time, this is Tom.
Oh, shit, we're doing a thing. Fuck, I didn't study. This is Jeff.
Bono.
There you go.
Okay, ready? Go. Do the spontaneous thing.
And now, we're here with J.M. Bell.
Was that spontaneous? How do you do a spontaneous jazz band?
Hang on. You're not behaving.